This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The 2021 legislative session has come to a close, and despite a global pandemic, lawmakers came together to propose and, in some instances, pass bills. But the session wasn't without controversy or tension. We've heard both Republicans and Democrats on this program discuss various items they were pushing for at the State House. But what was it like to be on the outside, watching things as they happened and reporting on everything? With us now to get a recap of the good, the bad, and the ugly of the recent legislative session are two reporters who cover Indiana's General Assembly. Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly, government and politics reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Thank you both for joining us this afternoon. Brandon, I'll start with you. Before we get into all of the details, what was it like covering this session overall this past year?
Yeah, it was weird, and a lot of times not in a positive way, unfortunately. I can use the last day of session as a great example, actually. So for the last day of session, and I technically the last day of session, that was another way in which this year was weird. They didn't technically end the session because of redistricting. But for the last actual day of session, the House, for its final floor day, decided to be in its actual chamber at the State House, which was the first time the entire year they had been in there because COVID-19 mm-hmm. safety protocols, social distancing had meant that they needed more space. And so they had moved across the street to a government center building. They had been spaced out and it was awkward. And a lot of lawmakers talked about how they really didn't like it. That last day of session, they were like kids, giddy children, at getting to be back in their chamber. Part of that was also because the session was ending, I won't lie. But they loved being back in that room. And honestly, so did I. Getting to actually be around lawmakers, talking with them one-on-one. Everybody, well, Democrats and the press wearing masks, Republicans, quite frankly, not so much. But getting to be around lawmakers, be in person, talk with people, even if it's not like officially on the record talking to them, was something that I personally missed out on a lot this session. I did a lot of my reporting, quite frankly, from my office at the State House because so much of the way we had to cover the session was virtual. So it wasn't a positive in that way. But I will say all of the ways they changed the session worked. We never had a stop or a shutdown or a hiatus to the session because of a COVID-19 outbreak. There were cases. There were times when lawmakers and staff had to be out, but never widespread enough that it stopped the business of the General Assembly, which is a huge surprise and a credit to all of the really behind the scenes folks, especially, who did all of the work to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like maybe they're an example for other government entities on how to do things right during a pandemic.
It would seem so. Yeah. I mean, it clearly worked.
And Nikki, what about you? What was it like reporting this past session? And were you also having to do a lot of virtual stuff?
You know, I really tried to continue going to both the House and Senate chamber. I know, obviously, with radio and TV, they have different audio needs than I need. So I tried to continue working in the chambers as much as I could so that I could have FaceTime, so that I could chat with lawmakers. So in that sense, but obviously for committees, you couldn't really go into the committee room. So you couldn't really talk to the quote unquote real citizens coming to talk. So that was a little difficult. So, and you know, every time we had an availability, there was, you know, an online component and an in-the-room component, and it was just very awkward a lot of the time. But overall, I mean, I think they did a pretty good job. And I know on that last day in the House chamber, at first I was like, well, that's kind of an odd move, you know, to take all these precautions this whole time, and then on the last day, shove everyone sitting, you know, elbow to elbow at these chairs. But you know, a lot of people were vaccinated by now, and there were a lot of, you know, changes since we started back in January. And I think it was nice to actually be back in the regular chamber for that end.
Does it seem like they're going to do that moving forward, be in the chamber? Was that like a test run?
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any reason not to be in the chamber as long as we continue to sort of progress on the vaccination numbers and kind of limit, not limit, the cases are there, obviously, but the severity, the hospitalizations and deaths are much more plateaued. And so I think as long as that progress continues, there isn't any reason why we wouldn't be back in there in next January.
Mm-hmm. And Brandon, you know, with the pandemic, what was that like for lawmakers? Did it change the way they had to get things done? Did they implement new, I don't know, procedures?
They tried to keep as many of their procedures as, I mean, some of them are set in just House and Senate rules. So those are easily changed by lawmakers. Some of them are not. Some of them are in the Constitution or in state law. So you're not changing those. So in many ways, they couldn't change too much. But I mean, the legislative leaders talked a little bit about some of the changes they saw because of COVID-19 that they would like to see remain in place going forward. And a big one is an increased level of communication between lawmakers across chambers. So House lawmakers talking to Senate lawmakers and vice versa. And we saw that play out as the session got closer to its finish line in what's called conference committee. So conference committees always happen right at the end of session. And it's when a bill has passed through the House and the Senate, but both chambers can't quite agree yet on what they want that final bill to look like. Those happened far less this year. We saw a lot more of the House just agreeing to whatever changes the Senate made to one of their bills and vice versa. And that was because legislative leaders really stressed to their members, we need to, like, we can't have a million conference committees because communication and meeting in person and all of this stuff is more difficult. We need to get this stuff worked out ahead of time. And they did in a lot of cases. We saw more what are called concurrences, which is when the original chamber agrees to those changes. We saw more concurrences than I think one person said we'd ever seen before in a legislative session. And so that level of enhanced communication, working out the final details of these bills before they get to that last stage in that process of conference committee, is something that legislative leaders really emphasized. They liked how it played out. And I know they're going to emphasize it in the future. It remains to be seen whether they'll be successful at that. But that was, yeah, that was a big way I think COVID-19 changed how the session normally operates.
Mm-hmm. So would you say they became more efficient?
Yeah, in many ways, yeah. Efficiency is a big part of what they did. And that also led to other bills dying off that maybe in another year they would have tried to keep pushing a little towards the finish line. But this year it was a lot easier to say, you know what, we're good.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of legislation, Nikki, did the pandemic impact certain bills in any way? For example, what lawmakers decided to focus on?
Well, yeah, I think the pandemic brought to light a lot of problems that were going on. And so you saw that reflected in some legislation. A great example is a lot of Hoosiers had to use telehealth during earlier parts of last year when they couldn't go to their doctors. And so we did a pretty wide-ranging telehealth bill, basically putting things into law permanently that were approved during emergencies through executive orders so that you can do more of dealing with your doctor through phone, video, you know, that kind of stuff. And we saw things in the final budget where, you know, I think we realized we have some real broadband problems. And so they used money from the federal government, $250 million, to put into broadband access. Those are examples of things. And we did the same with a health grant, because as we saw, base health issues were obviously a big issue in who was severely impacted and died of COVID. So we definitely saw things that we discovered or maybe didn't discover. We knew they existed, but they were brought more to light during the pandemic. So we definitely moved forward on those things, either making them permanent or putting money to try to help increase, you know, awareness or help on those things.
Did anything surprise you about what lawmakers focused on or ignored this year?
I don't think it was particularly different. I would say one thing usually in other states, we've seen a lot more movement toward banning abortion to try to get some sort of test case up to the U.S. Supreme Court in its differing format. we did not hear those bills, not to say they didn't touch occasionally on some abortion issues, sort of full throttle on some of the more social issues.
And on that note, Brandon, were there any significant issues that were just plain ignored this year?
I'm sure there are significant issues depending on who you ask. I know the Democrats have really pushed for increasing the minimum wage, as they have for a long time. But they saw, like Nikki talked about, the pandemic really shining a light on how many of those essential workers, people who were designated as essential last year, are making minimum wage. And we haven't increased the minimum wage here in Indiana for, I think, over a decade. No, I don't think. I know it's over a decade. So that's one that, I mean, didn't get a hearing, didn't get more than a little bit of floor debate from amendments that the Democrats offered. So that would be something. But again, depending on who you ask, there are plenty of issues that are significant to folks that didn't get a hearing or didn't get attention. But, you know, legislative leaders talked about at the end of session when we talked to them about how the COVID-19 session, because, again, all the things we talked about, it really did sharpen their focus. So that goes to even to some of the bills that ended up dying. It's just a matter of we have to focus on the things that are the most important in our view to helping Hoosiers recover from the pandemic, setting the state on a good path to come out of the pandemic, that sort of thing. And it sort of makes those other issues that in a normal session might get more attention just by the wayside.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that the two parties became closer during the pandemic? Did their relationship improve?
No. I mean, we've had supermajorities here in Indiana in both chambers for nearly a decade now. And that relationship hasn't really changed much. There was a really bipartisan kumbaya moment at the session's very end when it comes to the state budget. But that was more a case of just you can't say no to that much money than any sort of closeness between the two parties. So, no, they're about exactly where they are, which is to say, though, that 90% of the bills that Indiana's General Assembly passes are overwhelmingly bipartisan, if not unanimous.
All right. Well, just ahead, what were the big bills of the 2021 legislative session, both monetarily and profile wise, plus what got passed and what didn't? We'll hear more from Brandon and Nikki after the break. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. With the 2021 legislative session officially over, we can now look back and play Monday morning quarterback, analyzing what passed and what didn't, and if the pandemic played a hand at influencing any lawmaker decisions. Before the break, we talked about the overall feel of the session with Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly, government and politics reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Now let's get into the juicy details of it all. The biggest price tag came with the state budget that was passed. Nikki, $37 billion for the state budget. Before we get into the details, is there anything that stood out to you regarding what was being prioritized?
Well, obviously, the priority is K-12 education. We spend half of our state budget every year on K-12 education. That will continue. And thanks to a very rosy revenue forecast a couple days before the end of the session, they plowed almost $2 billion into K-12 education. So schools are definitely going to see an increase. We also expanded some school choice options. So those were, you know, the education was by far and away the big winner of the budget.
Was this budget any different than past budgets in any way?
Well, it was different in that we had all this federal one-time money that came from the stimulus. So we needed to appropriate that while the legislature was in town. We also had one-time state money that has built up in our reserves. So we were also appropriating that between the one-time, the $37 billion number you used is sort of the ongoing expenses, which is your basic household budget. But then separate from that, they spent $5 billion in one-time state and federal dollars. And it's massive, the amount of money they've put into different programs, from infrastructure to broadband to health to learning loss to pension debt pay down, that kind of stuff. So that was very large.
Do you think this budget will actually accomplish what past budgets may have not?
I mean, that just depends the perspective you're at. I mean, I definitely think it raised, you know, increased some spending on some issues that have long been an issue. It increased spending on food banks. It increased spending and for direct service providers who care for people in their homes. You know, it definitely did some things like that that we haven't been able to afford in past years. So we'll watch the implementation and see how that goes.
And Brandon, you had a story where the headline was saying that there was shockingly overwhelming support for this budget. Why was it shocking?
Five people out of 150 lawmakers voted against the final budget. I haven't found anyone who remembers more overwhelming support for a budget bill in memory. Generally speaking, the majority party votes for the budget. Most of the minority party votes against it. Not necessarily all of them. There are usually, for instance, over the last decade, there are one or two or three Democrats who vote for the budget because maybe they got a particular project in it that their colleagues didn't. But this was, I mean, not a single House Democrat voted against the budget. That's, I mean, the only two people in the House who voted against it were Republicans. That's just unbelievable. That I think that's, to me, maybe the most shocking thing of the session, and it happened on literally the last minute. And a big part of it is all of this money, both in the one time and in the as Nikki mentioned, the revenue forecast that projected $2 billion more in ongoing money over the next 2 years. And what was a big part of why it was such a bipartisan vote is because, you know, you had Republicans saying, look at all of the, you know, this is what our Republican-led fiscal management has gotten you, a budget that can do all of these things. And what Democrats could say is, well, look at the impact that the federal stimulus has had on what we are able to spend money on in Indiana, not just the one-time spending in their mind. But if you look at the COVID relief package that was passed by the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress earlier this year, they think that contributed significantly to that really positive revenue forecast that we got right before the end of session, with way better numbers than expected on sales and individual income tax. Well, when you pump a bunch of money into the economy the way that relief bill did, that's sort of what happens. So everybody found a reason to be able to support this budget, and that's why it was... I think going into that final day, Nikki and I, in fact, were talking about this with some of our colleagues. You know, it became a conversation of, oh, okay, how many Democrats do you think might vote for the budget this year? To, oh, holy cow, how many Democrats won't vote for the budget this year? And that number ended up being only three, which I think stunned all of us.
Well, what were some of the issues that the folks who didn't vote for it had? Do you know?
The two Republicans, only one of them spoke on the floor about it. They are the two most conservative members of the Indiana General Assembly and often vote against their caucus for ideological reasons. And John Jacob, a representative Republican from Indianapolis, kind of alluded to the idea that while this budget spends all of this money, they're not doing any sort of taxpayer refund or tax cuts for Hoosiers. And he seemed to take some issue with that. So I would suspect that was his issue with the budget, perhaps. But the three Democrats who voted against it in the Senate all said that while they loved all of the money that was being spent on traditional K-12 schools in the education portion of the budget, they loved that it finally incorporated some of the recommendations from the governor's Teacher Compensation Commission, that the teacher pay was finally being put at the forefront in this budget. They couldn't stomach voting for a bill or a budget that expanded private school vouchers as much as this one did. They said they couldn't bring themselves to vote for it. And that's where those three no votes came from.
Well, speaking of education, Nikki, we kind of touched upon the fact that, you know, this budget is giving significant funding to K-12 education as budgets in the past have. What kinds of discussions were there at the State House about this funding and what they're hoping to accomplish?
Well, I mean, the discussions largely centered around teacher pay because Governor Holcomb and, to a lesser extent, Republican leaders have been saying for several years, don't worry, we're going to get to the teacher pay issue in the next budget. And then COVID hit and suddenly we weren't sure about our funding. And so suddenly there wasn't going to be any money to address a gap in pay compared to other Midwest states. I mean, they were still going to give an increase to schools, but when you're getting an increase, the original increase that was discussed was like 1.2% the first year. You and I know what that means. We got a 1.2% increase and inflation goes up double that and our healthcare goes up, then there's really not money for a teacher pay raise. So the last minute forecast allowed them to put 4.6% in the first year and 4.3% in the second year. And they did also include, as Brandon mentioned, a couple of the recommendations from the teacher pay condition. First of all, it says that it sets $40,000 as a minimum teacher salary. It's technically a guideline, but if you're not meeting it, you have to basically send a letter to the State Board of Ed explaining why you're not meeting it. It also requires that 45% of all the money you get through the tuition formula be spent on salaries. And that's fascinating. We have more than 100 districts who currently aren't doing that. And I think lawmakers had resisted sort of a mandate that this is, but at the same time, they're like, look, if we're going to put $1 billion into, you know, the tuition formula, then we need to make sure it's going to get to the teachers. And that was an example of what they did.
And what about when it comes to higher education funding? Is there any information on that?
Well, higher ed was originally cut. We made cuts last year when the pandemic first hit and there was a lockdown, lack of revenue. They were cut 7%, I believe. So the first thing they did is they restored those cuts for the first year of the budget, and then they gave them a 2% increase in the second year of the budget. But I'll be honest, the big thing that a lot of the universities are, you know, a little upset about is they didn't get a single capital project. A lot of higher ed things, usually the budget always has, you know, buildings at various colleges and universities in the state, and they are either paid in cash or through debt service. And for whatever reason, the legislature just decided, nope, we are not giving them money for buildings right now. There was some mention of not knowing where education's going in the future with all these online classes and things like that. So even though we had all this one-time money, we definitely could have said, each university, you get to pick your top capital project, but they definitely did not go there. And that was, I think, one disappointment for higher education.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brandon, the state budget also mentioned removing debt for the state. How significant is that reduction?
It's not insignificant, particularly when it comes to another recommendation from the Teacher Compensation Commission, which has to do with a teacher pension fund. The state has been paying it off for a long time and will continue to for around a decade or so. But they were able to reduce that debt by hundreds of millions of dollars. Governor Holcomb had asked for $400 million. They ended up putting, I think, more than that in the final because of all of this federal, $600 million, that they ended up reducing that debt obligation. And that does a couple of things for you. On the one hand, it reduces, now that's not money that will go directly to teachers in that way. But what that does is it frees up money in the state's general fund in the future. Something in the area of like $90 million a year. Because it was, I think, around $70 million on the 400. So I think it's about 80 or $90 million on the $600 million. So that saves up money in the future. They also did the same thing with some capital projects, buildings, highway infrastructure projects that they had been paying off that debt over time as they were expected to. Well, if you can pay the rest of that off with cash, well, now you're not paying the interest on it. It frees up some money in the future. Particularly that one-time money came in. That's a great way to use it to save you in the future. So they really did emphasize that.
Well, we have a question on Twitter, Nikki, from Chad, who says, Governor Holcomb is suing the General Assembly over a veto override. What can be said about this relationship within his own party?
Well, you know, that's something I haven't seen in my 25 years covering the legislature. And I've only found one other example way back in 1941 where a governor sued the legislature. One thing I found fascinating about this, this is all over this issue of emergency powers. And they passed a bill that said the legislature can call themselves back in during a statewide emergency. Now, the leaders of the House and Senate will say, oh, no, it's great. We think Governor Holcomb did an amazing job. This is not about him. This is about future powers and that kind of thing. But if you talk to the rank and file members of the Republican Party, that is not their line. They do not think the governor did a great job. They are annoyed that they didn't get to come back in last year and cut off some of the restrictions that the governor had, mask mandates, business capacities, those kinds of things. So I do think it showed a disconnect between leaders and rank and file, and then between rank and file and the governor. And now we're going to be in this legal quagmire as this lawsuit goes to, you know, to court, because there's, you know, that meanwhile, the governor went out and got his own attorneys because the attorney general said he couldn't file it. The attorney general is now going to represent the legislature. And the tack they are taking is that the governor doesn't have the right to file it. And so that doesn't even get to the real issue, which is this unconstitutional or not? So I think we're going to see this play out in the coming weeks and months, and it could get very, very interesting.
Right. I mean, this is one of the controversial issues, I think, for the session this year. I mean, there's some other little things that happen here and there, but this kind of sticks out at the end of session that this is going on. Brandon, what are your thoughts on this situation?
Yeah, I agree with everything Nikki just said, but something has stuck with me this entire time. And maybe publicly, and maybe it's been going on behind closed doors that we don't hear about. But Nikki is right. Rank and file members of the Republican caucuses were not a fan of many of, I won't even say many, some of Governor Holcomb's executive orders, particularly the stay-at-home order right at the beginning and the mask mandate. They really hated the mask mandate. But Governor Holcomb has said through this entire process, and he has been backed up by Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray and Speaker Todd Houston, Holcomb asked those leaders multiple times, do you need to come back for a special session? Because right now, the governor is empowered by the state constitution to do that, only theoretically the governor. And he was told, and Bray and Houston have said, we said, nope, we don't need to come back for a special session. You keep doing what you're doing. I have not heard the kind of anger that lawmakers have directed toward the governor directed at Bray and Houston. And what's more is, if this law that they passed to be able to call themselves into a special session in the future, if it is constitutional, if it is the law of Indiana going forward, that power to call themselves back in still rests with legislative leaders.
Right.
So rank and file members won't really have, I mean, they'll have more of a say in that sense that they can ask directly their leadership, but it's still the legislative leaders who ultimately pull the trigger on calling that special session. So I have been flummoxed this entire debate why there wasn't more public frustration directed at those legislative leaders as opposed to just the governor, who in many ways wasn't the roadblock for rank and file lawmakers here.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting perspective. And I think, you know, I'm just curious to see how this all plays out. But also, the two lawmakers that didn't want to call things back into special session, is, do you have any sense of why people aren't turning against them?
I mean, in a sense, it doesn't benefit you oftentimes as a rank and file member to upset the head of your chamber. They control committee assignments and bill schedules and committee chair personships and things like that. So in that sense, you know, it doesn't do well to piss them off, quite frankly. But at the same time, I mean, I've also heard nothing in the way of, you know, these people being replaced, certainly nothing close to that. And I don't think that'll happen. So no, I don't quite understand it, other than they're worried about retribution. But I also don't really see that happening much, mm-hmm. even with people who are the few random members who are a little more outspoken. So, yeah, I that one has, yeah, like I said, it's flummoxed me this whole time.
Mm-hmm. And as Nikki mentioned, this is what, maybe the only the second time this has ever happened?
Yeah, only the second time that the governor sued the General Assembly, certainly. So how that plays out is, I mean, I'm giddy. I'm so excited about the legal battle that's about to play out, because it's just, yeah, it's a mess. But for a political journalist, that's a good kind of mess.
Well, yeah, it's fascinating. And Nikki?
I was going to say it's very exciting, but we do have to remember this is all going to be footed by taxpayer dollars, and these legal fees are going to be massive.
Well, that's something I was wondering about. We have to take a quick break, but I'd love to pick back up on that. Is just, you know, how much is this going to impact the taxpayers? Coming up, we'll hear more about bills that made it through and the ones that were thrown out as we continue to take a look back at the 2021 legislative session here in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about the 2021 legislative session in Indiana that just wrapped up last week. And the session was not without controversy or heated debate. We'll hear more from our guests today on some of the bills that stood out this session, whether they passed or didn't. With us again, Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly, government and politics reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette. Before the break, we were discussing the lawsuit Governor Holcomb has filed against the General Assembly. What impact could this have on taxpayers, Nikki?
Well, I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think it's going to break anyone's budget per se, but it is money that could go to other services that will instead go to lawyers to fight out this battle. And frankly, it's a battle that was warned early on in the session. And, you know, now it felt like at some point both sides dug in and wouldn't even listen to the other side's sort of perspective. And, you know, and it's not only just the constitutionality, as I mentioned, it's the second issue of who can sue and when, and, you know, can you actually challenge this before it's, you know, someone has invoked it. So I imagine that it's gonna move through pretty quickly, but also, you know, I don't know that we will for sure get any answers.
Right. And Brandon, you know, the governor has his own lawyer. Are we going to have to foot that bill as well?
Yep. That'll be something that comes out of his budget. Again, as Nikki pointed out, this is not, you're not going to see budget cuts have to be made because of this lawsuit playing out. Certainly not with a $37 billion budget that has $2+ billion in reserves in each of the next 2 years. There'll be nothing like that. It won't approach that kind of level. But yeah, it is. It's time and attention that could otherwise be paid to serving Hoosiers. And of course, all three sides, if you want to consider the attorney general, sort of. But both sides would argue that they are serving Hoosiers by playing this out. Lawmakers felt like they were serving Hoosiers by changing the emergency powers statute, whereas the governor feels like he's serving Hoosiers by challenging what he believes to be a blatantly unconstitutional law. But, you know, yeah, as Nikki pointed out, they all knew this was coming and they still went ahead and did it anyway.
Right, right. Well, back to some bills and things that have been pushed for. Brandon, there was debate at the State House for years about increasing the cigarette tax in Indiana. Did those discussions go anywhere this year?
No, and I would argue they made less progress this year. So this has been, as you mentioned, a years-long fight with advocates that really run the gamut. It's not just health organizations. The Indiana Chamber of Commerce has been knee-deep in this for years. And their argument is not, we need more money, so we need to raise the cigarette tax. Their argument has been that study after study tells you that a surefire way to help people either stop smoking in the first place or help them quit smoking is to raise the cigarette tax. And that price point at which you sort of start to see that behavior change is at least $1 per pack, and it's really $2 per pack. And that's what these organizations have been pushing. We've seen a $1 per pack increase pass the House in past years. It passed the House Health Committee this session. But the House Republicans only put a 50-cent per pack tax increase in their budget. And then the Senate just didn't include it at all. And we finally got a bit more of an answer about potentially its long-term future from Senate Republicans this year, which is that Senate Budget Architect Ryan Mishler was asked why he didn't include it. And he looked, said it this way. He believes, as his predecessor in that role did, Senator Luke Kenley, who retired a few years ago, they believe that at some point the federal government is going to stop paying for as much of the Medicaid budget as they currently do. Right now, the federal government pays for the vast majority of that, and the state has to pay for some of it too. Well, Senator Mishler and Senator Kenley before him are kind of terrified at the idea that the federal government at some point is going to say, nah, you got to pay for way more of that. And in that situation, they won't want to, you know, cut the program necessarily, but in order to generate the kind of money you would need to shoulder that burden, they think that raising the cigarette tax is going to be that ace in the hole for if that day ever comes. Now, I can personally be skeptical that that day is ever going to come. It's certainly not going to come under the current presidency, but that's their reasoning for not raising the cigarette tax. They look at it as a money issue. That, yeah, it's not the be-all, end-all financial answer, because as you raise the tax, fewer people smoke, which means the tax revenue will eventually go down. But they look at that as the answer if they have to take on more healthcare costs. And until and unless that happens, I'm not sure we see much movement on a cigarette tax. It's certainly not out of the Senate Republican caucus.
Was there any debate with the cigarette tax that people might cross over to another state to buy their cigarettes? I know in Illinois, that's the big thing where people go to Indiana to buy their cigarettes because it's way cheaper. Was that at all a component?
Yeah, that's always been an argument for gas station convenience store retailers who have long opposed any increase whatsoever. But that doesn't seem to be the sticking point. It feels like everybody's kind of on board with the idea. And now it's just a matter of, well, when do we do it and why do we do it? There are some who want to do it for health reasons. There are others who say we're going to need the money someday, so let's wait until we do. It's just a matter of, I think, time, but that time could be way in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's definitely one to keep an eye on. Nikki, one piece of legislation that got a lot of attention this year was the police reform bill. Can you let us know a little bit about it and what it looks like the impact of this bill will be?
I would actually argue it didn't get enough attention. I mean, we certainly covered it, but I bet if you went up to random people on the streets, they wouldn't know about it. House Bill 1006, they started working on it right as the summer, you know, the protests were happening. And they came up with a number of things in that bill that all the stakeholders could agree on. And I mean all, like all the police unions and all the community groups. And it went through, I think, without a single no vote, which is unheard of for major things. It does a lot of things. It increases some penalties for instance, if a police officer would turn off their camera or block the camera so that they weren't caught doing something. It makes it easier to decertify a police officer if they've done certain things wrong. It makes it harder for officers to sort of go from agency to agency. Let's say they get accused of something, but they quit before, you know, there's a finding, they go apply over here. There's been some problems kind of getting that information from agency to agency. It limited chokehold use. It added de-escalation training. So it has a lot of things in it that I think were directly in response to some of the issues we've seen around the nation. And I definitely think more people need to know that Indiana came together on these things and got some real progress out of those protests.
Mm-hmm. And I'll even add on to that a couple of one of the things that Nikki mentioned, the idea of making it harder for an officer to go from agency to agency. One of the ways it does that is what Nikki said, which is better information sharing. But we actually saw an example of how Indiana law, this new Indiana law, would have played out. The recent shooting in Minneapolis, the officer involved there resigned almost immediately, like within days. And it's a way to avoid sort of the disciplinary process from playing out. If you leave the department, the disciplinary process pretty much ends. Well, one of the changes that the Indiana bill makes is, with a couple of exceptions, that disciplinary process does not stop even if the officer leaves the force. So that's going to play out. And again, that plays into making it harder for bad officers to get jobs in other agencies, because if there's no way to continue that disciplinary process, well, you know, you could look at the officer's record and see, well, there's nothing on here from the disciplinary board or whatever. So that's another way that, again, we're seeing things in other places that Indiana's law is already going to address.
But does this law water things down a little bit, you know, because there was such overwhelming support from both sides? I know we had some of the sponsors on the program before, and everyone just seemed so, you know, happy and in on the same, I guess, yeah. level. And it just felt like, is this really a police reform bill, or is this maybe a start to something?
Yeah, it depends on who you talk to. I wouldn't say it waters anything down. All of the reforms that are in the bill are good. There's a question of where do we need to go from here? I think a lot of the police groups and folks on that side of this debate will say, well, we're done. Like, this was fine. We're okay now. Obviously, there are a lot of other things that groups like the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus, the NAACP, the Indiana Black Expo, et cetera, the Urban League, they would like to see things go a lot farther. They, for instance, the Black Caucus had a much more robust agenda around police reform, and not everything that they advocated for got into this bill. So is there more that they want to see done? Absolutely. Was this bill watered down? I would argue no, but it certainly doesn't go as far as many advocates want to see, and I'm a little skeptical of whether we will see more sort of robust police reform measures in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nikki, lawmakers passed a bill on vaccine passport language. Now, that's kind of a contentious topic, vaccine passports. What does this bill do?
Yeah, honestly, it's this wide-ranging health bill. When we say passed a bill, it's 30 lines in a like 53-page bill. So it mostly handles other things. Literally, all it says is that a government, state or local, cannot issue or require any sort of a vaccine passport. And the phrasing is basically like, basically the status of your vaccine status. So, I mean, on one hand, I guess, okay, but I didn't know of any governments doing that. Or, I mean, it's sort of this big topic, but haven't seen anything actually moving in that manner in Indiana. So I think they wanted to just have it there in case, but I'm not sure that it has any practical impact.
Yeah, because more importantly, it doesn't impact the private sector at all. When this idea of vaccine passports was originally broached in the session, which really happened for the most part very late in the session, there was more language about private entities and what they could and couldn't do. So for instance, original language that was set to be voted into law, but ultimately was sidelined through a procedural process, said that a private business couldn't restrict someone from entering the public area of that business. So thinking about the Indiana Pacers and Bankers Life Fieldhouse, they couldn't restrict someone from going to Bankers Life based on their vaccination status. Well, there's absolutely nothing in this bill as it finally passed that has anything to do with the private sector. So it'll be interesting to see if something like that plays out over the next year before lawmakers come back for their regular session next year, that will prompt them to enhance what state law does and doesn't allow.
Mm-hmm. Is this unusual, Nikki, to see things get passed sort of like preemptive ahead of time, just in case?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to happen more lately. I think what happens is someone will get a hold of something that happened in California and they'll say, well, we don't want that to happen here. So just because it's happened in one other state, they'll suddenly bring, you know, a bill here. And obviously anything related to COVID, this is an evolving situation. So no, you know, no bills were filed really on it at the beginning of session, but, you know, everything changes. Obviously at the beginning of session, we barely had a vaccine. So vaccine passports weren't really a topic. Now, to be fair, though, it definitely was not what I would call a sterling process. Language passed that was never before heard in a public hearing. Citizens did not get to have their say. And technically, you're not supposed to put something in a conference committee report that hasn't passed one chamber or the other. We ignored that rule. So, you know, they felt like it was needed. It wasn't something that was, because it was not overly broad. It didn't create big contention, and so it just went in kind of smoothly there on the last day.
And as we get ready to wrap up the program, Nikki, is there a bill that didn't make it through that surprised you?
Oh, the big one is the gun permit bill. There was a bill that would have eliminated gun permits in Indiana right now. If you want to carry a gun outside your home, you have to go through a license. You have to get a background check, get your fingerprints, you know, stuff like that to get a license. It was moving. It passed the House easily. It had like 23 or 4 co-sponsors in the Senate out of 50 people. And yet the Republican Senate refused to even hear the bill. So that was a little shocking. There were some problems with a database in there, but I was surprised that they didn't at least hear it and try to find an answer. But they somewhere were just like, we're not touching that this year. And that was even before some of the more recent mass shootings. Mm-hmm. So I think that will easily come back again. It's only a matter of time before Indiana joins, I think, 19 other states with permitless carry.
Mm-hmm. And Brandon, how about you? Was there anything that stood out to you that didn't get through this year?
A lot of bills that would have really taken away control of issues from local governments and placed them in the state government. Several of them didn't reach the finish line. And that, I don't know that it surprised me, but it was interesting to see the mix of what did and what didn't pass. I think, you know, for listeners here in Indianapolis, the bill and or language that would have really cut the knees off of Indigo here, that ultimately didn't reach the finish line, despite the best efforts of Republican Senator Aaron Freeman to really kneecap that program at every turn. Other language that had to do with where wind and solar farms could be placed in a county. The legislature was looking at saying, well, we're going to standardize what that is. They were looking at language that would have standardized building, sort of the way you can build things and the look of things across the entire state. That didn't reach the finish line. So there were a lot of efforts, especially early in the session, to really take away local control on a variety of issues, and a very small number of them actually reached the finish line. So it was interesting to see how many of them fell by the wayside by session's end.
Are there any things that you think will be making a reappearance next session?
A lot of the ones that I just mentioned, quite frankly. I don't think Aaron Freeman will ever give up his vendetta against Indigo. He really hates it. I think other things like the wind and solar thing, the building regulations, these clearly matter to some lawmakers. And as long as they are in the legislature, they're probably going to keep advocating for them. They also matter to whatever interest group is pushing them to do it. We'll probably see some of that stuff come back. But it's always a flip of the coin as to whether or not it gets to the finish line.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining us and giving us the 411 on the state politics and bills and things that passed and didn't pass. I feel like I have to digest all of this information now. Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Nikki Kelly, government and politics reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you want to hear a repeat of this episode or a past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Not sure you want to travel during a pandemic? We'll have some ideas for a staycation. Plus, we'll learn about the art of foraging. Join us for that tomorrow. Connect with us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.